Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Daniel Cole, co-head of investment banking at Opportune LLP. During the episode, Daniel shares his views on the market and some of the trends he's seeing around deal flow, buy-side activity, E&P development, and interesting dynamics on transactions that have taken place over the last few years. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Daniel had to say.
All right, Daniel, good evening. Welcome on to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks. Pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity. So thanks for having me on.
You bet. So the investment banking arm of Opportune is fairly new. I'm sure a lot of the folks listening know you from some of your past lives. Wanted to have you on. I've gotten to know Josh Sherman and the team really well over the years. And I was pleasantly surprised to see how active you guys are in the mineral and non-op space and some of the deals you have currently and what you're working on for future mandates. So let's dive into that, right? What you see in the market, your trends, et cetera. But before doing that, just set the table. So kind of yourself, a little background professionally, and then just describe Opportune holistically and all the different verticals and how they complement your iBanking team and, feel it gives you guys a good advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm somewhat unique in that I started out my career in investment banking, that is, as a geologist up in Appalachia, worked with Chevron for a number of years, and then, kind of made the switch over to the dark side, if you will. About 8 years ago, joined the UBS A&D team, worked there for 6 to 7 years before having the opportunity to join the Opportune platform, which was a really exciting opportunity for a number of reasons. One, starting a new platform, a new investment bank, and partnering with Daniel Rojo is a great opportunity. But in addition to that, the offerings of the firm, I think, are really going to supercharge our business and kind of the A&D focused investment bank that we're looking to that we were looking to launch and are well into launching already and have already picked up a number of really exciting mandates. So, the firm more broadly has an incredibly diverse offering from, back office outsourcing, valuation, reserve engineering, complex financial reporting, tax advisory, business transformation advisory that, we have tentacles throughout the oil and gas business, all the way from downstream to upstream to minerals. And so all those connections really made this an attractive platform to set up an A&D focused investment bank. So, call it at 12 months ago at this point, we joined on, sought to hire a team of highly experienced professionals from other investment banks, some really great guys, and, got into it, right? Our first two deals that we closed were A&D sell side advisory. We're also working on a number of different capital placement strategies, whether it's development capital, kind of your traditional drill cos, all the way up to we're closing a debt placement advisory right now where we're helping a company recapitalize their debt stack. And then the last kind of leg of the table, if you will, is fairness opinions and kind of formal valuation work. So it's a great business. We've got, 4 or 5 different sell side mandates we'll be launching here shortly. We're working on kind of pre-work on a couple of hopefully minerals mandates that we'll be bringing to market here really shortly and just very excited about launching this business on a already very successful platform that's been around for 20 years or so.
Great. And you guys aren't new to the space. When you were at UBS, you worked on a handful of deals, right? So I think kind of transferring that experience and those relationships over to Opportune, it's not like you're starting from scratch. So you want to maybe touch on that briefly, maybe some takeaways or learnings from, working the mineral space in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. At UBS, we were a little more focused towards kind of the capital market side of things. But we also did a number of sell side advisory, M&A advisory, merged a couple entities together, had a number of minerals focused sell side mandates that, kind of got us entrenched in the business. And so what we're looking to kind of, move over to the Opportune platform is kind of bring that bulge bracket service, the focus on how to put together IPOs, if you will, down to the middle market, right? And target deals, call it in the, $75 to $300 million space. And by bringing kind of the level of expertise, the attention to detail, the marketing strategies, I think we can really differentiate ourselves and bring a very high quality product that'll maximize value for our clients.
Good stuff. All righty. Well, you know, I think one of the reasons investment bankers add a lot of value to the market is it's your job to speak with everyone, have an ear to the ground, and, you know, not only leverage those relationships to execute on mandates, but bring some color to what's going on and different trends that are out there. And so, you know, prepping for this, you and I kind of highlighted a bunch of different things you guys are seeing that, you know, kind of tie back to the minerals non-op space. Let's start with commodity price environment. You know, what kind of view are you guys taking both on the crude and the natural gas side? What are you seeing and how do you see that affecting deal activity?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we're off the highs of last year on both crude and even more markedly in terms of natural gas. And really the dramatic pullback in natural gas has really stunted the market, specifically for minerals in that space, right? When your NTM cash flow multiple is materially lower than it was, you know, 8 or 9 months ago, it's kind of hard to rationalize that. So anytime there's a major price volatility, specifically like what we saw in gas, it really kind of chills the market. That said, oil, while there has been a somewhat of a price pullback, it wasn't nearly as material, nor has it had an impact in slowing the markets down. And so, you know, what we see from the oil side of things is you know, largely a range-bound price bouncing between, you know, call it high 60s into potentially low 80s, right? And that kind of stability in the market, you know, is what can effectuate driving deals and closing that bid-ask spread. With gas, it's a little more interesting, right? Where you have a contango forecasted in the strip. And so effectively what the traders are baking in there is, you know, increased demand from material increase in LNG projects being brought online. And so the real risk to that that's, you know, associated with these major capital projects, they don't get brought online or they go down or something happens and you know, creates a major perturbation to the gas market, whereas, you know, we remain in oversupplied or more tightly supplied situation. So I think folks are a little more tenuous around that. And I think there's some hesitancy that we've heard among buyers to really fully lean into that contango that I think continues to hamper gas-weighted transactions, particularly in the mineral space. But those oil transactions are still, you know, moving forward.
Do you know where you're going to be on October 10th later this year? If your answer is not the Minerals and Royalties Assembly and Awards Dinner, then drop everything you're doing right now and go online to get registered. If you're serious about deal making and networking in the minerals and nano space, then I expect to see you there.
Yeah, you know, on the flip side, for someone who has a gassy asset and they're looking to sell, you know, at a high level, you would say, you know, unless you really need to, why would you look at selling at these prices? The counter argument that someone brought up to me, I thought was fairly interesting is, well, if a buyer can hedge and lock in these contango prices, they can actually pay a decent number. And it's not like it's bottom floor pricing across the way. So that's interesting. And then, yeah, I think everyone's kind of banking on 2025 onwards, a rally in gas and the LNG projects coming on. So time will only tell, but, you know, Freeport LNG going offline was a, you know, a major disruption that no one really saw. And I don't follow that day to day. I believe it's still offline and, you know, a bit of a question mark. Regulatory, I've heard all sorts of conspiracy theories that, you know, Washington was involved in getting it offline and threw a bunch of red tape at it for, you know, for Biden's, you know, political agenda of, you know, getting prices down for Americans going in the winter. So who knows? But nonetheless, no one has a crystal ball. And I think the real value on the gas side is probably more on the ground. White space deals still trade, right? Because, you know, that stuff's coming online in 26, 27, maybe. And, you know, the five-year strip isn't that different. So you can still transact eye to eye on those. And then, you know, folks who need to let stuff go, I think, may have some other compounding factors, lines of credit or what have you at the lower level, and may need to turn them. But the bigger portfolios you're going to be marketing, I think it's sit and wait, right? For sure. And in the interim, oil assets, Permian assets in particular, are the ones that are probably going to come to market that have scale. So another thing you kind of noted here was development activity, you know, backlogs of DUCs and permits. I'm curious for you to expand upon that. That was definitely a footnote post-COVID, and I'm wondering how much of that inventory has been burned through. I see all sorts of commentary out there from various, research analysts and some of these independent data firms talking about inventory running out and how years ago it seemed like there was decades of inventory that E&Ps would never get to get through because they didn't have enough capital. And now, well, that's not really true. They're running out of inventory, at least the core inventory. So that kind of is a juxtaposition to, the backlog and all this, drillable inventory that you're talking about here with DUCs and permits. How's it all fit in? What are you guys seeing?
Yeah, so certainly the oil-weighted DUCs have reached what we call equilibrium, right? There's a natural DUC inventory in the market, and I'd say we're largely at that, right? There's obviously going to be isolated situations where, for whatever reason, an operator's DUCing a well for an extended period of time. But as far as kind of market equilibrium, we think it's reached that. We are seeing the DUC inventory grow on the gas side, right? For the exact reasons price-wise we just discussed, folks are very reticent to complete into a 275 gas price. Rather, hold on and see if the contango proves true. So I think we're going to continue to see that DUC inventory increase. We have seen, gas rigs lay off and reduce in rig count kind of from the plateau that we've seen over the last 12 months. But, hey, the oil rigs have stabilized, right? We grew out of the COVID low and operator activity seems to have reached some level of equilibrium on the oil weighted side. Now, with regards to inventory, yes, it is a consideration for everybody, right? You see it in the, to switch over to kind of the operated side of the assets, the Permian is turning over, right? You're seeing assets trade, I won't necessarily call them tier two, but they're outside of what folks would traditionally call all the core areas, right? And that turnover is associated with folks, the operators, particularly the large publics who want a footprint in the Permian, looking at their 5-year, their 10-year development program, and they are seeing an end to that core tier one inventory. And so when they look at other deals being consummated and completed and looking at the number of names on the board of potential A&D and M&A opportunities, the list continues to get shorter. And so on the upstream side, I'd argue, there's a little bit of a FOMO potential going on in the market where we need the inventory. We're looking at our 10-year schedule. And yes, it's starting to hit that. And so, we need to do something about it. And so what does that translate to for, kind of the non-op and mineral space? I think many of these deals are going to be really positive, right? You look at the Reliance SM deal on the upstream side, that's going to drive a flurry of activity into Dawson County and Northern Midland Basin. So if we use that as an example of something that's going to be material for mineral owners, right? I mean, the price that they paid, in my view, is underwriting at least a 2-rig program. So you're going to see material development move into that space. On the other hand, right, some of these deals that get consummated, you see the public operator elect to slow down the pace versus the private operator, right? Right? The Diamondback, Firebird, Lario is a classic example, right? They took 4 rigs operating on the private operators and are reducing it down to 2. And so, there's going to be changes, but, my interpretation overall, it's guiding towards a stable rig pace, right? And that's helpful from a broker and marketer standpoint like myself, and that everybody kind of understands what they're underwriting, right? Anytime there's a lack of volatility and element of stability, it works to kind of close the bid-ask spread in the market.
Okay. Now, Talking about rig count stabilizing real quick. I think for the publics coming out of COVID, it was a lot of rhetoric around capital discipline and prove to investors, even when prices run up, that you're going to stick to it, earn our confidence back. These were the headlines. Private operators don't really have the same constraints. And so you started to see folks drilling more actively on the private side. It was interesting during COVID because of, the crazy environment we're in, a lot of folks wanted to buy minerals under blue chip public operators because, they had the capital there and they were going to be consistent. Last year, you start to see a little bit of a pivot where they said, hey, we want some private exposure because these guys are drilling like crazy. Where do you see rig activity on the private side? Is it as as different as I'm describing? As it, again, found an equilibrium like you're referring to on some of these other themes?
No, and the trend you described is absolutely correct. So historically, pre-COVID, you look at the U.S. onshore rig count, it's 60% public, 40% private. COVID, right, caused a dramatic decrease in the amount of rigs. And on the backside of that, it inverted. And it went 60% private, 40% public. So private were rapidly capturing market share from the public operators. And so what you had there was a situation whereby the public guys were, you know, trying to maintain capital discipline, return cash flow to investors. They were much slow to react. And then over, you know, that trend persisted for about 12 months. And today it's largely stabilized at 50% private operators, 50% public operators. So right now, and, you know, it's been that way for about, you know, 6-12 months, it's a good 50-50 split. But you look at, you know, your top 25 names of who's running the most rigs, only three of those names are private operators. So when you think about it, right, the big public guys are putting a ton of capital to work. They have a much larger footprint. And then you have, you know, call it 300 to 400 private guys that are each putting 1 to 2 rigs to work. And largely what that averages into is a 50-50 split.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's talk about deal flow now. So 2023 has been pretty slow out of the gate. I'm trying to reference some talks I've seen this year, you know, mirroring kind of COVID levels, right? Just very, very slow, particularly in minerals and non-op. You know, I've gotten calls from a handful of the larger end buyers being like, hey, Tim, we're going to sit in with our board. Like, we're supposed to talk about market opportunities and what's out there. And are we missing anything? Like, have you seen anything that's kind of off market or know of anything? And, you know, it's just interesting to hear that. That means there's a bit of angst on the buy side to see stuff, right? Now, you guys have a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. I think we started to see a couple deals trade. There's a bunch of stuff out there in the market. So it has heated up a bit in Q2 and going into Q3 for sure. But just generally, why don't you kind of give us your thoughts on what you're seeing and what the drivers of that might be?
Yeah. So the overall A&D market, believe it or not, the volumes on a quarterly basis have largely mirrored what we saw in 2021. In terms of kind of transaction volume, but in terms of quantity of transactions, it's been a lot less. So fewer larger deals have gotten done. Particularly the middle market has been, you know, call it the $100 to $300 million bucket, hasn't seen a lot of transactions vis-a-vis what we've seen historically. In the mineral space, there's an even more dramatic trend, right? So, you know, on average, we see approximately $400 million of cash deployed per quarter. Now, there's obviously quarters that are materially higher than that when the public guys issue equity. But, you know, largely over the last 3 or 4 years, the average number has floated around $400 million. Over the last 2-3 quarters, we haven't even been able to break through, you know, half that, right? We're hovering, I think Q1, we were just over $200 million. Q2, we didn't even come close to $200 million in minerals deals that were announced, right? I'm talking about just the publicly marketed transactions. So, you know, let's think about what the dialogue is here, right? And how I interpret this chart and flow. So you come out of COVID, right? Everybody's finished hunkering down. You go into a period in the second quarter and third quarter last year where we had windfall prices, right? $100 plus oil, $9 plus gas. Minerals companies are throwing off a ton of cash flow, right? They're building up cash reserves. In fact, all oil and gas companies are building up cash reserves, right? And the debt throughout the industry is at an all-time low. But operators, right, they can turn the switch and start to deploy more into capital, deploy more into drilling. And we certainly saw some of that as rig counts stabilized into 2023. Minerals companies, they've got to buy to continue to grow, right? You've got all this cash, you've either got to distribute it or you've got to redeploy it into capital. And those that have a really robust ground game are able to keep up, right? And continue to deploy, you know, take up new mineral buys. The larger companies, you know, the ground game is just not sufficient. So they need to rely on a functioning A&D market to grow. And I'm not saying the A&D market isn't functioning, but everybody was flush with cash. In addition to that, there's been a material slug of new capital targeting minerals that was raised in the back half of 22 into 23, particularly on the family office side, whereby going into 23, you've got a large pool of generally well-capitalized buyers and no deals coming to market or very few deals coming to market. And so what that's driven is a very strong buy-side demand in the mineral space. And so what I'm telling my clients is if you've got a minerals package that you're considering selling, selling, the supply demand dynamics of the market have never been more in favor of a seller. Now, you may not agree with the valuations, but I'd love to sit down and share some of the recent transactions because, you know, I think valuations are very aggressive vis-a-vis what we've seen in years past.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50K upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. As a leading global energy business advisory firm, Opportune is well positioned to provide world-class technical, financial, and operational capabilities to minerals and royalties companies. Whether it's back office outsourcing, resource and reserve definition, land due diligence and administration, GIS mapping, valuation work, data and system integration, financial reporting, tax advisory, or buy and sell side assistance, Opportune LLP has got you covered. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
No, listen, timing of, you know, getting the relevant eyes on your package is part of it, right? I mean, there aren't endless end buyers in this space. Nick Vero, when he exited Wing the first time, he talked about being ready to sell at any moment. And the market kind of dipped in early 2018. Everyone went on their heels. They actually continued forward with getting ready to sell. Prices rebounded. Boom. They were out the market. No one else was out. He had all the eyes and they did a deal with Alliance. So there's something to be said about that for sure. Because if you want to go out, I'm just making an example. If you have a large Haynesville position and you're going out and you got a couple of strategic buyers and they're busy on a Permian process, it's like, shit, you know, I was kind of banking on them to be my buyer. Now what? So it is important to make sure you have a sense of people's bandwidth out there and what other deals are coming to market and timing that so you can get the right folks looking at it, right? Because at the end of the day, these end buyers probably only have the ability to do one, maybe two large multi-$100 million deals a year. So if they swallow one of them and you're late to the dance, then you can miss out an opportunity with them and they could have been the right strategic buyer. So no, I think all that insight is interesting. The slide I have up here that your team put together also shows the equity and the cash split on deals. You know, obviously the big outlier in Q3 2022 was the City of Brigham merger. So let's throw that out. But, you know, in general, you know, when you're looking at all cash deals or a mix, what are some of the drivers you see there? I think what makes the public space competitive and also kind of hinders it sometimes is broader macro. And if they're not able to use their equity, they're usually beaten out by the private market, right? And the private market comes in with all cash. And so you see these droughts, like during COVID for sure, the publics were very much out of the market. I think there was maybe one deal and, you know, kind of coming into early 2021. But as their stocks recovered, markets got better and there were some tailwinds, all the publics started to do deals. So just your comments on really the strength of the buyer from sellers willing to take equity when they want all cash and the nuances in between.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally seller dependent, right? I mean, particularly some of these larger, you know, tightly held minerals companies, right? The family office or the ultra high net worth individual that's selling, you know, a large minerals piece. There's a lot of reasons to take stock, right? A lot of tax reasons that, you know, will result in a potentially superior outcome vis-a-vis an all cash sale. And obviously all cash, you know, cash is king, right? Getting that, that equity. So, you know, putting all that aside, I'd say, you know, look, the cash stock split is less of a consideration, right? You've got many of these public companies now, as I mentioned previously, are throwing off a tremendous amount of cash flow, and they have to find a way to reinvest it, right? You know, you can dividend out, you can reduce your debt as Sitio's doing, but at the end of the day, you want to be able to do deals. But, you know, the bottom line is there are a couple of very large deals in the market right now, and it'll be interesting to see if the public companies end up gobbling them up. But with regards to the middle market, the private buyers, from what I've seen, have been more aggressive than the public companies, not just in terms of cash and equity split, but just in terms of valuation. Now, obviously, Kimball was able to get a deal done here very recently, and you know, congrats to those guys. But a number of the, you know, call it three of the last five deals in the Permian Basin, for example, were private buyers, right? And it was, you know, in based on what I understand, you know, large family offices that are taking a very long view, and it's enabling to be, you know, enabling them to be aggressive around valuation. So it's not a market like what one would expect where, you know, the public companies are going to be the most aggressive buyer. That's going to be the inroad. There are some very aggressive private buyers out there right now. And to the, you know, public guys' credit, they're remaining disciplined with regards to their valuations, right? You know, many of these companies have excellent multiples that can enable them to be aggressive from an accretion dilution standpoint, but, you know, they're looking for, you know, a good deal, not just an accretive deal.
It's an interesting discussion that gets brought up over beers a lot with guys in the mineral space is who's the ultimate end buyer of the minerals asset class? And I think, like you said, traditionally you think, oh, it's the publics, right? But the publics haven't always been that competitive. I think a lot of guys who have scalable portfolios look at the metrics and they go, well, it makes no sense to sell to a public or and take their paper or try to go public on our own. We'll just keep doing what we're doing, maybe for and wait for a better day. So you start to see, you know, billionaire and like huge family offices have made a splash. John Arnold did a bunch years ago, and you know, Saxum has a similar type player behind them, and they're raising a fund. You know, Saxum just bought part of the old Lux mineral portfolio. I had Charlie Schufel from Elk Range on the other day. He mentioned that. And, you know, Saxum did a third of the Mason Minerals portfolio. So there seems to be kind of that, that's an iteration that's a relevant player going forward, right? Now, are they buy and hold forever? Not sure, but there seems to be some other considerations at play for a family office type investor, right? Whether it's tax related or what have you. Then you have, I call it the private equity hybrid model. I think what's brilliant, you know, NGP Royalty Partners definitely led the charge on this, but years ago, you know, everyone's thinking pensions and insurance companies are going to come in a big way. They're going to be these unicorn buyers, and they're going to be the ones that buy these huge portfolios. And, you know, you had Heritage, you know, Ontario Teachers came in, they did a bunch of big deals. Longpoint had CVPIB, Echo had Texas Teachers. So that was like 2015, these pensions came in. And after that, there really wasn't really any large pensions doing anything at scale. There wasn't really that much in the insurance space. So Alliance pops up, right? A coal company, they start being active. And then, you know, Franco Nevada's done a bunch of big stuff. They're kind of like an alliance, you know, with gold. They're kind of this diversified natural resource player. So there's been a couple of new ones every year, but like not enough to swallow up all the private equity. So I applaud NGP Royalty Partners goes out and creates basically an exit solution for themselves or a way to buy themselves time for the end market to evolve. And a perfect example of that full cycle is Darren Zanovich's Mesa 2 vehicle, right? They saw a lack of end buyers in the space, thought they could be more competitive upmarket versus on the ground, which is how they built their portfolios traditionally. They go out, they buy Live Oak, another private equity-backed portfolio by Denham, now Trace, right out of the gate. And then in relatively short order, have sold down most of that portfolio, a portion to Whitehawk, Daniel Herz's shop, portion of Saxum, and made great returns. And so I think they basically bridge the gap in a 24-month period of, you know, kind of they didn't buy it from themselves per se because it was not an NGP portfolio, but they bought it from another private equity firm. And then you see, Elk Range, it was undisclosed, but they bought another private equity firm's Eagle Ford package recently. And that model is an interesting kind of in between, not an end buyer into perpetuity, but an in-between buyer that's competitive depending on where the public sit in the macro scene, right? So I think that's been an interesting trend for sure. And then you look at international buyers, in particular on the public side, Freehold's come in and been a big player. And are there, I think going back to the question of who's the ultimate end buyer, I think it's probably ultra large international family offices and other types of international investors that have other motives to hold these incredible assets. Real assets in the U.S., not a lot of political risk, kick out yield, hedge inflation, all the things that are attractive to U.S. investors, but it may be, a little bit of a your willingness to take lower returns because, we're not used to having assets repossessed and also to other political risks that you face in these other countries and a way to park your wealth, elsewhere and, protect it from local jurisdiction, energy security, hedge on that. If you're a European investor and you see what's going on with Russia and the Ukraine war and what happened to gas prices, if you could own natural gas minerals, I know of some family offices that are viewing the world that way. So I don't know. The space, I kind of look at it in waves. Private equity came in big in kind of the middle of the last decade. Then you had a couple of pensions. Then family office funds really started to form. Lately, it's been a couple of billionaires. But now it's just kind of a mix of like all these different categories. And there's two or three a year. And the space continues to grow. I think one of the roles yourself and your peers in the banking space play that, all the mineral, I don't know if it's fair to, put the pressure on you guys, but it's who's going to bring the next new buyer. And I think you guys and the others running these sell side processes, that's one of the responsibilities to try to uncover these new empires and help grow the space, right? But I don't know, I hit a pause. I've been rambling for a little bit. Just curious to kind of hear your thoughts on how you've seen the buyer universe evolve and some of the trends and some of the drivers behind that.
Yeah, for sure. So, certainly, I agree with all your points around the buyer universe. I want to add one motivating factor, right, that I've seen particularly recently. It's if you want to make a long oil and gas commodity bet, you want to put $100 million to work on that bet that you think oil and gas prices are going to go up. How do you do that, right? Well, you could buy, the other side of swaps, but, there's not $100 million of demand for a 5 to 7 year out swap at $50 a barrel, right? I mean, there's just not. People aren't taking that trade, right? So if you believe oil's going to $100, maybe even $150 a barrel, there's really not a great way to play that. Other than, buying minerals, right? You can buy an asset whereby all your CapEx is up front. You've got a, depending on where the asset is, right? Either a flat to slightly growing or even slightly declining profile, and you're buying it, typically underwriting a strip pricing. So in my view, why some of these, longer hold investors like family office have benefited from processes and been able to outcompete is they've got a more aggressive outlook on oil price, right? And you can very well get to a 20 to 30% IRR over a 10 to 15 year period if you believe oil is going to $100 a barrel during that, 10 to 15 year period. The cash flow will mount, rig pace will pick up on your acreage and you'll have a much better investment vis-a-vis if you look at it using just strip pricing, tailing down to $50, $60 a barrel, it's a 10% rate of return on 3P, which nobody's really excited about, right? There's much more liquid ways to do it. So that's, I think, an interesting dynamic that I've heard in speaking with a number of buyers that have a longer time horizon that's really relevant and resonates. It, other than buying an operated company where you're going to be exposed to inflation risk and all these other things, minerals lacks those risks. So it's a more pure way to get an oil price exposure.
I think that's super interesting. At the end of the day, what are minerals? They're an option on the future development of oil and gas reserves. So when you look at, talking about buying the other side of a swap or whatever, you're buying an option. And so especially that's why I think think guys like John Arnold and, you know, the individual who's an anchor with Saxum, they're traders by background. That's how they build a lot of their wealth. So I think you're spot on there because they took a view and, you know, they are able to put capital behind that view vis-a-vis minerals. So super, super interesting. And listen, I always have a front row seat and am excited to see a name that I never heard of or never thought would enter minerals pop in. And that's what makes the space continue to be fun, right? Let's talk a little bit about transactions. You know, you and I traded a list of deals before the call here. I listed a couple ones that I thought were interesting and notable. Happy to open the floor for you to, you know, pick out some things, you know, thematically that were interesting to you. I'll start with Kimball. I thought it was interesting. You know, Kimball buys Hatch, $290 million, pretty big deal for them. I think the biggest since Haymaker, right? And to date, in the public space, if you have a diversified portfolio of scale, Kimball's your only real end buyer, right? That's a much smaller bucket or universe, I should say, of buyers. If you have stuff in 12 states and, you know, it's scattered and there's not a pure play story to it. But then Kimball comes out and buys a pure play Permian portfolio, very heavy in the Delaware in that, right? Then 4 months later, they buy another pure play Permian portfolio, Sabalo, for $143 million. So now the diversified buyer in the market plunks, you know, $400+ million into pure Permian assets. Interesting. Individually on the deals, they value creative, good for the Kimball stock, I'm sure, right? But just thematically looking at that caught me by surprise. If I was running those processes, I don't even know if I send Kimball those deals, if I'm going to be frank. So
you got to send Bob all your deals. Come on now.
Yeah. But, you know, what do you think about that? I think it's interesting. And then what's their next move? Is it Permian again, or did it go back to the same playbook? I'm curious.
Look, I mean, that's the benefit of being diversified, right? You don't have to be bound to, you know, just a diversified strategy, right? And those transactions, while, you know, a market number are, you know, relatively small, you know, Kimball still holds a diversified strategy, I think, in everyone's mind. But what it just leads to the Permian, right? When you look at the levels of growth, the production, the levels of future inventory that you would classify as tier one, like the Permian's got it, right? That's the basin. And you know, you've got, you look at all of the growth since coming out of the low of 2020 in US oil production, the Permian is about 95% of that growth, right? The other basins have largely had development that will abate their decline, maybe with a more modest growth, but the Permian's screaming, right? So if you're a minerals buyer and you know you believe in that growth that like Kimball clearly has, that's going to enable them to win in these processes, right? Because you're not gonna, if you don't believe that there's going to be a growing bait, you know, the person that wins the process is the one who believes in the most growth, you know, generally speaking, right? And they clearly saw that trend and stepped up to it, and I think they're going to be really happy with those deals given the continued trajectory of growth that we see going on right now.
Yeah. Another thing, kind of a side comment or tangential comment on those transactions, looking at Sabalo, that was a minerals portfolio of an E&P company backed by NCAP. I'm blanking on the name, Petro Legacy. So Petro Legacy just sold out and they've retained their minerals portfolio and they're actively now looking at going to market as well. Do you see this as a wave of assets coming to market going forward? Is the operators out there, predominantly private equity, I'm sure, because they structured this way, separating minerals from the operated assets up to a certain NRI. And, you know, this has been happening for since these private equity firms were set up, right? But I can't really remember anything happening transactionally. The fact that now these are starting to trade is interesting. And they're real scale, right? $143 million is a real portfolio in the minerals world. So, you know, if Petro Legacy comes to market and that trades, do you see, are there a bunch of others out there? Have you had conversations with groups? I think it's an interesting trend.
Yeah, no, there absolutely are, right? You think about the, you know, I know of at least three private equity backed companies that have minerals portfolios that they're going to be divesting of separately from their upstream assets, right? And you think about the evolution of when minerals really started to kick off and the evolution of this generation of private equity funds, right? Or private equity backed portfolio companies, right? They could see other people doing it, right? And so they said, well, shoot, we've got boots on the ground. We should be leasing minerals underneath ourselves. We have a differentiated view vis-a-vis your average mineral buyer on when in this area is going to be developed. And so we need to leverage that. And there are a number of businesses out there that'll be doing just that. So yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to see that, you know, maybe this year, if not definitely next year, there'll be, you know, some of these larger private equity backed portfolio companies, to the extent they exit their upstream, it wouldn't surprise me to see a minerals exit, you know, right behind it.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford, with deal sizes ranging from 50K upwards of 5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs. The Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Need energy industry management experience at your fingertips? Opportune LLP, a leading global energy business advisory firm, has the capabilities needed to overcome your minerals and royalties team's technical, operational, and financial challenges. To learn more, search Opportune's podcast, E2B, Energy to Business, on Apple and Spotify Podcasts, where Opportune examines emerging financial and technology trends and provides a broad perspective on ways to stay ahead, create opportunities, and execute market strategies. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Very cool. Well, everyone stay tuned, right? I think that'll be an interesting space to watch. So moving on, these are kind of, and again, please interject with some deals that you found interesting, but February 2022, KKR buys out an $805 million asset from Apache in the Delaware. I remember months before this, I got a few calls from some of the big end buyers, and they were saying, Tim, who out there could take down a $500+ million minerals asset? And I'm like, $500+ million? What asset is that? Right. And, you know, maybe Heritage, but nobody. Like, and whose portfolio is that? I was stumped. Right. And so I wasn't aware of this deal being marketed at the time. You know, it comes to light. There was a bunch of buzz around NAEP. And so I got way more color on it. And it was really interesting to see the dynamics play out around that. It was a lot of private equity funds just at the fund level battling it out. Right. So making it up. Quantum, NCAP, whoever, they go out and they raise private equity fund 9 or 12 or whatever vintage they're on, and they have 8 billion or 4 billion or whatever. They were taking those war chests to the table to try to take this down. And the Porcos were almost like the underwriting teams. And I don't know structure wise how they were looking to take that down. There's a couple interesting partnerships, right? Folks bringing title to the table, folks bringing certain underwriting skills. So that was a really interesting process. And I think at the top, that's probably the biggest asset deal. I know the Brigham and Insidio merger was the biggest deal to date, but that was an all equity public merger. In terms of singular asset, that's by far the biggest deal that there's been. And so I think it was just one of these moments in time in the mineral space where it's like, this is a unique opportunity. we need to jump on this. And, you know, it reminds me of the Canadian space. Heritage was formed by the royalty portfolio being spun out of Cenovus years ago, right? And Prairie Sky was born on carving out the stuff from, it was in Canada, now Ovintiv. I think up in Canada, the only one of scale of that scale left of Canadian royalties is Exxon. And I don't know if that ever trades, but I don't really have full visibility on how many more of these types of portfolios are sitting inside of operators. But it'll be an interesting space to watch and just see how that dynamic plays out. You know, the other thing that was interesting, so Holbrook Dorn, you know, who kind of runs Crescent Mineral Partners for KKR, manages a lot of their stuff, were, you know, I haven't spoken to him directly about this, but I know through others, you know, he went and front ran the title, which is a playbook he's used at Blackstone Minerals before, and they closed the deal, no diligence. And that was a ballsy move, but what was needed maybe to, you know, make moves and get that deal done. So that created all sorts of chatter. Now, is this an expectation that sellers are going to have going forward, that buyers come to the table with that, those kinds of terms in order to trade? I haven't really seen that since. But anyways, I'll take a pause. Your thoughts on it, because it was a really fascinating series of events that unfolded around that.
Yeah, that was certainly a competitive process, and they differentiated themselves with that maneuver totally. You know, I'd say broadly, right, folks ask me all the time, right, what's too big, right? Where's the sweet spot in the buyer universe? And, you know, you certainly do get to fewer buyers with larger deals, but, you know, those larger deals are and can be much more appealing due to the ability to deploy big slugs of capital directly out of funds, et cetera. So, you know, there are a couple of large minerals deals of that ilk, potentially, you know, much larger on the horizon. So, you know, there are a number of massive portfolios out there, specifically with regards to operators, right? I mean, you know, the biggest mineral owner in the United States is probably Chevron, right? And I don't know that they're going to be selling their minerals anytime soon. I know they're very, it's helped their economics immensely on the upstream side, but Apache also has their Midland minerals, right? And so, you know, there's certainly a lot of opportunities out there, but there's a tremendous amount that's just in private hands, right? Very large folks that have aggregated these portfolios over 20 to 30 years that, you know, will be able to bring significant value to the market to the extent they want to monetize. So, you know, I think there's definitely some product out there to be sold of that size. In terms of, you know, talking about a billion-dollar deal or somewhere plus or minus $300 million from that number, you know, I think absent funds deploying directly like what you saw there, you know, there's probably 5 to 7 guys that can do a deal that size, including some of the public names, right? I mean, that might be too big for a number of them when you start to look at the fact that they're going to have to deploy equity. Now, there's some large public companies, TPL being a great example, that are sitting on cash war chest right now. You know, they've got $650 million of cash on the balance sheet, right? When is that going to get deployed? And that's not a unique, right? That was a specific example. But, you know, many of these operators are reducing debt and preparing for taking down some of these larger transactions, and they want to do it. And many of the public guys need to do it to continue to grow scale, get relevancy. You know, I think there's certainly a race to see, you know, who's going to be the first, you know, public minerals company to tap into the S&P 500, right? Can we get enough float to get to that level and get all the benefits of liquidity and coverage that come with a material market cap?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, kind of moving on, some other things I think are interesting. I think, you know, so Daniel Herz, he ran Falcon. He started his own shop called White Hawk, and they've been funding deals through the non-publicly traded REIT space. Yep. So you look at structure and just, you know, dressing the cat in a different way or dressing the pig in a different way. They're definitely doing it. So they came out of the gate, $53 million deal with San Jacinto in Appalachia. I think it was a quarter of the portfolio that was marketed. I remember at the time, all the big funds in Appalachia were watching that San Jacinto process. If this trades at a good multiple, is this now the floodgates that opens up the precedent for our portfolios to be sold? And ultimately didn't get to a number San Jacinto wanted, but they did end up carving out a quarter of that. And, you know, Daniel's been on the podcast several times and has talked about every time they've done a deal, but they're funding those in tranches over a period of time, which is fairly interesting. And they're going out to the retail market to do that. And then they just did another $105 million deal with Mesa in the Haynesville. And they're on path to be the natural gas consolidator of choice. That's Daniel's vision, right? And there's a handful of others out there trying to do the same, just with different mousetraps and different strategies. But you know, that is just another example, kind of talking about the mineral buyer universe, tapping into a different pool with a different strategy. It's interesting. So I don't know, just kind of thoughts on that.
Yeah. No, and I have to be kind of careful, right? Because we, you know, when I was at UBS, we were advising Daniel on that transaction. So I'm not going to comment on that one, but certainly in terms of, you know, retail, I think it's a great strategy, right? What Daniel's put together there is unique. It's novel. I want him to be successful in what he's trying to do. I guess the only concern I have is, what's the demand out of a retail REIT space, right? Is it going to be $1 billion of demand, or is it 150, right? Right. And I'm excited to see him kind of push those limits. But, you know, as far as calling 5 or 10 different companies with the same strategy, I don't think there's that kind of demand for that to be a new product. That said, right, there are some really novel concepts coming out of, you know, different debt structures. And, you know, can you partner with an asset manager of a large fund, right, or a hedge fund type structure that has cash flow coming off, and structure a deal similar to that, right? So if you've got an asset manager with $10 billion under management, throws off, you know, somewhere between $50 to $60 million a month in cash flow that they've got to reinvest from all their other investments, you know, can you peel $9 or $10 million of that off a month and deploy that directly into minerals and do a rolling close concept like that, you know, to build scale, to build a continual cash flowing vehicle? I think that's really interesting. And that's something we're looking to continue to investigate, right? So it's a similar strategy, but, you know, looking at it from a private kind of asset manager standpoint, right? And I think you've also had the Donovan Venture guys that are kind of looking at it from a different angle, trying to raise yep. retail around an ABS. And that's also an interesting novel concept in the market. So
they're trying to create an equity structure that kind of has the look and the feel of an ABS product, right? Yeah. Energia is the platform. I had them on for an episode a couple months ago. Yeah. And again, it's just different types of products and structures to just give a little bit more seamless access for certain investor pools to get access to deals and transact, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, a couple more things here before we wrap up that I think are interesting. So you have Kayne Anderson coming back into the space. You know, I think Kayne Anderson was with KKR and Haymaker. Haymaker, you know, builds up their portfolio, get a successful exit to Kimball. And then from what I heard in conversations, whether it's with Kayne guys or guys around the Kayne camp, is that, yeah, they're not going into minerals ever again, right? They just, and some private equity firms have kind of drawn that line in the sand, right? And then, you know, Landrun comes out, buys his big mid-con portfolio, you know, 200 plus million. I think it's interesting, like in itself, that deal is impactful to the A&D markets because nothing of scale is traded in the mid-con in a while since the technical reset. And that used to be the 1-2 punch next to the Permian for all the big minerals buyers years ago. So that was interesting. And, you know, so Kayne did something there, I think more in a direct fashion. Now Kayne's partnered with OneMap, buying stuff on the ground, the Permian. So Kayne is back in the space and interested. But yeah, I don't know. That mid-con portfolio went to market several times too. And, you know, it finally traded. I think rigs came back, pricing recovered, a little bit more of a development component. It was just the right time to let it go. But, you know, any kind of thoughts from your seat?
No, 100%, right? I mean, not to say, you know, throw Kayne under the bus, but a number of different people have said they're out of one sector or another only to be dipping their toe back in, right? At the end of the day, you know, private equity guys are great in that they're entrepreneurial. They're looking for, you know, ways to make returns, ways to make, you know, good returns on that. You know, one thought right around the mid-con, I do see it returning, right? What, you know, minerals, I think, is going to be lagging, you know, what we're seeing on the operated side. You know, certainly activity levels have returned to the mid-con and the scoop stack that are enabling there to be, you know, some modest growth there as opposed to continued decline. And with that increased level of operator activity, it's going to drive the minerals deals to market and ultimately trade and match that bid-ask spread, right? I mean, we all know why the technical reasons why the mid-con went through a period where it was out of favor, but for the exact same reasons, right? Some of these tier two Permian assets are coming into vogue and trading we're going to see the MidCon come back into vogue, right? People are looking at that 5 to 10 year drill schedule and where's it going to be, right? So I'm not calling for a big operator entry into the SCOOP stack, but I'm not saying it's an impossibility. And you know, historically we've seen minerals lag, you know, 6 to 12 months behind some of the trends we see in the operated space. So I absolutely believe, you know, MidCon's going to be coming back and we're going to start to see more aggressive valuations and more competition in that space. Just, you know, for no other reason than the Permian as well has seen a tremendous level of competition and valuations have been driven up. So if there's an opportunity to capture what's perceived as a better deal in another basin that may not have the high growth levels, I think we're going to see it happening. And I think we're going to see folks continue to diversify away and into basins like that.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has a short memory. So everyone forgets how much capital was deployed into the Anadarko in 2015 to 17 for minerals. Shit, it's already been 7 years since that flurry of activity. So, you know, when you think of a minerals investment, you know, 7 to 10 plus years is when you really start to see the serendipity kick in. So as these large portfolios start to mature, names start to trade, change over time, you forget, right? Echo and all these, but they're being held by the investors. And at the right time, they can be monetized. And then boom, $200-400 million asset trades hands. I mean, Long Point One just sold. Sixth Street just bought it out, right? That was a material position of both Permian and Anadarko. So it's starting to happen, right? And it'll be interesting to watch going forward. You know, the general feedback I see from folks looking there is they're like, there's parts of the Anadarko that are still really good and there's parts that are really bad. And you have to kind of know what you're looking at because there's some landmines in that basin for sure. So
yeah. Oh, it's 10 to be complex for sure.
Yeah. And then we'll wrap it up here. Got to talk about Sitio and just kind of the journey. It's been, from an A&D perspective, a pretty busy one, right? So their route to the public markets was a long and arduous one. You know, it started, I had Casey Stallings on a month or two ago. It started with, which is how, you know, Cambridge formed the name Desert Peak. It was originally, you know, a cash acquisition from Desert, and there was a JV and they were going to buy together and maybe contribute more assets. COVID really screwed those marriage plans and they ended up dissolving that and ended up just being a cash transaction. But then after that, you saw a pivot. You saw equity mergers with Rockridge, which, you know, was part of the Blackstone exit from oil and gas, and Source, right? Brandon Benson came on, talked about that merger. And there were a handful of other moves to get scale. And then they filed an S-1. Market conditions got a little rocky. They ended up pulling it. And then they ended up going public with the merger with Falcon, who was stuck. So it was a good win-win on both sides there. And then, you know, after that, they did quite a bit, you know, foundation momentum. I think it was $560 million in the summer of 2022. So that was pretty notable. And then, you know, you think, I didn't see the Brigham Sitio merger happen, but boom, all of a sudden they double in size and they go from a pure play to, you know, a diversified public, which is another interesting thing, how the rhetoric years ago, right? Like you have to be pure play. It has to be simple. Investors won't understand it. Otherwise, that's kind of gone out with the bathwater. I don't really think it matters anymore. I think the asset class is the asset class. And, you know, are you able to distribute cash and returns to investors regularly? But just kind of watching that journey and what you see going forward, you mentioned who gets in the S&P first, the scale, is it 10, 15, 20 billion? What's that number? I think Sitio is really the one showing the most appetite to be that leader and scale and growth, right? But you know, over you wrapping up the episode, just your comments on their journey.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a great journey and Chris and team have done a great job kind of consummating those transactions. And, you know, I'd say, right, what's the critical number? You know, you asked me 5 years ago, it was 2 billion, then it got to 5 billion, then it got to 20 billion. Just the consolidation and changes in our industry have pushed everything to require bigger and bigger market caps, right? And so I think, you know, that's their strategy, right? Can we chase in my view, right? And I'm taking words out of their mouth probably, right? They're trying to seek scale to get true liquidity, to get multiple expansion, and you know, consummating all of these mergers and acquisitions is part of that. That said, at the same time, I commend their team and how you know disciplined they've remained. And I think on one of the earnings calls, right, Chris demonstrated some frustration around valuations and ability to get deals done. But, you know, nonetheless, that's they're remaining disciplined. They're seeking to grow at a reasonable valuation. And so I think we're going to see them continue to be aggressive and continue to make moves. But it's a question of, you know, how long is the family office bid going to be driving up prices, right? How long is a private equity bid going to be driving up prices? And if that's the case, you know, are they going to be able to buy on the metrics they want to in order to grow and capture that scale? Moreover, right, are folks still going to be willing to take their equity? I think so. I think they're a great name in the space, and their ability, you know, right now, while they necessarily haven't been as successful with transactions to pay down that debt, is just going to give them that incremental dry powder they need to you know, get that next large deal like the KKR Apache deal comes down the pipeline.
Yeah, I was catching up with Carrie Osicka the other day. You know, she was saying, you know, we are trying to stay disciplined to scale. And sometimes when we lose out on a deal, we go, that might end up being ours in 10 years. It'll come back to us, which is kind of a funny way to look at it. Going back to the, you know, the hybrid private equity model that NGP's deployed, if it ends up being Mesa that buys it and then sells it in a five-year period and Sitio's there, you know, to be the ultimate home, we shall see, right? But anyways, Daniel, it was good to have you on, and congrats to you and Rojo on growing the team and continue to expand and get deals done going forward. Just closing it out, you know, what do you want folks to think about when it comes to Opportune's banking team, and how can they get in touch with you and all that good stuff? Over to you.
Yeah, no, thanks. I'd say, you know, to the extent you have a situation, you need advice, give us a call, right? We're, you know, our specialty products are going to be kind of A&D and M&A advisory, debt equity placement, you know, bespoke capital transactions, fairness opinions. You know, don't hesitate to reach out. We've got our contact information available on our website, or, you know, happy to have my email address in the comments for folks to reach out directly. But we've assembled a tier one team, excellent technical folks, with all coming out of bulge bracket institutions. And we're looking to really deliver, you know, differentiated high quality service. And so we're excited to continue to make a mark in the market space and grow our business, and, you know, would love to partner with anyone out there that is in need of our assistance.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Daniel. You have a good night. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.